It's the basement.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to It's Debatable on Campus FM. The frequency is 103.7. I am Darren Katkuti and I'm going to be your host for the next half hour on It's Debatable. Today we are discussing illegal immigration. It is important to know the distinction between regular and irregular immigration. Regular immigration is that movement of people which is legal in the eyes of the receiving countries, that is having permission to enter a country while having identification papers, visas and all the right and correct documentation. Such migration can occur for a number of reasons and results from a series of push and pull factors, which can be either political, economic or social. And these factors we are going to tackle in our show today. On the other hand, irregular immigration is that movement of undocumented people who can go against the security measures of the receiving country once they come to enter it. Indeed, such migrants can be said to be economic ones in that they access a country to gain from its high standard of living or to gain from its asylum protection in the face of political persecution. On today's show of It's Debatable, we shall be exploring the concept of illegal immigration and its repercussions in the international relations scenario. Remember that you can join our conversations with your questions and comments by sending an email on info@mirsa.org.mt or else by logging on our online forum on mirsa.org.mt. Joining me now is our academic contributor for today, Miss Main Waring, who is a PhD candidate at the University of Oxford, and she is working on irregular immigration in Malta and Cyprus and the relationship of these two countries with the European Union vis-a-vis their immigration policy. Miss Main Waring, I welcome you to It's Debatable.
Thank you, Darren. Thank you for having me on the show.
The general principles of international law are today considered as an integral part of international relations, and rightly so also in the case of immigration. How do you think that we have seen initiatives taken by the international community, such as the Geneva Convention and the Law of the Sea, which also speaks about migration, do you think that the international actors are respecting these agreements that the international community has agreed upon, or do you think they are bypassing such agreements to adopt slightly more aggressive or dismissive policies towards immigration?
I think that in the Mediterranean, as you mentioned, the two pieces of international legislation that are most important are the Geneva Convention, which sets out the rights of refugees to international protection, as well as the Law of the Sea, which requires countries to come to the aid of people in distress at sea. Certainly, across Europe, you see a trend towards trying to externalize migration controls. So the recent agreement between Italy and Libya, for example, is a good example of how these migration controls are externalized. So Italy managed to persuade Libya to control its borders in order to stop the arrivals of migrants and refugees in Italy, and in consequence also in Malta. And these kinds of agreements basically close off doors to asylum in Europe. So as we know, there are refugees who are coming across the Mediterranean Sea, as well as economic migrants. And these kinds of agreements mean those asylum seekers and refugees don't have a chance to apply for asylum in Europe. Now, on the question of the Law of the Sea, Italy and Malta have had an ongoing dispute over whose responsibility migrants at sea are in terms of rescue. And in fact, they're both acting within their legal obligations, because Italy has signed up to an amendment to the Laws of the Sea, which states that migrants rescued at sea must be taken back to the coordinating country, which in Malta's search and rescue area would be Malta. So Italy says that Malta must take these people they rescue back to Malta. Mm-hmm. Now, that's actually in line with their legal obligation. However, Malta hasn't signed up to this particular amendment to the in the laws of the sea, and so they in fact are in line with their legal obligations to say that migrants rescued at sea should be taken to the nearest port, the nearest safe port, which is often Lampedusa in the case of Malta's mm-hmm. search and rescue area, because Lampedusa actually makes up part of Malta's search and rescue area.
Because our search and rescue area, as you rightly pointed out in one of your public lectures, is basically a colonial remnant of the British era, and that's why it is so large. But of course, the Maltese politician, for the Maltese government in general, also enjoys certain benefits because of the flight information area, right?
Yes, exactly. As you say, the search and rescue area spans over 250,000 square kilometers across the central Mediterranean, which is a very large area for mm-hmm. such a small island. There have been calls by the Italians, I believe, for that search and rescue area to be made smaller, in fact. But the Maltese government has resisted that because the search and rescue area coincides with Malta's flight information area, from which a lot of revenue is generated every year for the government.
So we also see the emergence of some conflicting policies from the Maltese government with regards to the revenue which is being generated from the flight information area, and also and then its obligations towards search and rescue, which might also be proving to be a strain on Maltese national resources.
Yes, I mean, it's, as you say, a big area for Malta to patrol and to carry out search and rescue. However,
We are speaking of Malta and Italy. We know that it surfaced in the news recently that both countries are calling for a temporary protection directive from the European Union. How do you think this would impact upon the migration flows?
Yes, Malta and Italy have called for the EU to activate its 2001 Temporary Protection Directive. Now, this directive was meant to be implemented in the time of emergency of a large mass influx of migrants and refugees into Europe. And what it would do would be to give these people temporary protection across Europe, and then those people could be resettled across Europe. And Malta and Italy have called for this mechanism to be activated. It's actually never been activated before, mm-hmm. Even though it was signed in 2001. So Malta and Italy have suggested that it should be activated in the face of these flows now from North Africa. However, the EU has refused to do so far. It has said that such a mechanism cannot be activated just for one or two countries and would have to be activated across the EU. I think also there are probably political problems with activating it in terms of setting a precedent, and there's a difficulty in defining what actually a mass influx is, and that's would be subject to political negotiations between all 27 EU member states. Instead, what has happened is that the EU has suggested that member states support Malta and maintain solidarity with Malta by resettling people from these new flows now in the past couple of weeks, resettling these people to other EU member states. And there have been some countries who have agreed to do so already.
Certainly. Ms. Mainwaring is a PhD candidate at the University of Oxford, and she is working on irregular immigration into Malta and Cyprus and the relationship of these countries with regards to the European Union. The debate now continues with my other two guests for today, Justine Mikhailov and Nicole Sherry, who would be discussing the pros and cons of immigration with regards to the European Union and Malta in general. Let me start with the concept of, we know that illegal immigration may have political repercussions. We have established that with our academic guest, Ms. Maine Waring. However, Justine, I know that you have rather a negative view on illegal immigration. What are the political challenges for the Republic of Malta as a tiny state in view of such significant influx of immigration?
Yes, as you said, Malta is such a small island, and obviously it has various limitations. First of all, Malta is a rock with no natural resources, and it has the highest population density. There are severe scarcity of water, and the island is incapable of producing enough food for consumption. So given these factors and also other factors which limit the opportunities that Malta can offer to its citizens and also to these people, I can conclude that it is very difficult for Malta to cope with such a situation. Also, if we take into consideration what, for example, the European Commission Vice President Verheugen said about, for example, burden sharing, which is a principle that Malta is choosing to adopt. Verheugen said that burden sharing, the burden sharing principle, was obviously not working. This principle is when EU countries take a proportion of illegal immigrants to their own countries. Verheugen said, for example, that northern countries don't want to disassociate themselves from the problems of the countries in the Mediterranean, and the Libya crisis confirms that burden sharing is somewhat difficult to adopt. And also, we have just witnessed the rise in diplomatic standoffs between Italy and Malta. Because of strategic interest, and because the nearest port of call is usually Lampedusa, but immigrants are saved into Maltese SAR, which is the search and rescue area. So there are various problems which the Maltese government has to face.
Nicole, I turn to you now. Are there any other factors which the government needs to take into consideration when implementing its immigration policy?
You have to take many aspects into consideration. First of all, I have to establish the point that what my colleague has said is right, and the fact that Malta is a tiny island and we have these limited resources. However, Malta has also been reputed from many times before as a hospitable country. And this cannot be seen more clearly than in the humanitarian status it has taken in the Libyan crisis. Malta, in the international scenario, has come forward as a country which has offered its solidarity to protect the citizens of European countries from the peril in the Libyan crisis. So this must go to say that Malta, despite the fact that it has these problems, has to remain being hospitable and continue with its reputation of the past years.
I mean, this concept of hospitality, I mean, has been demonstrated in our history. Even Malta was commonly referred to as the nest of the Mediterranean in the past wars. However, Justine, of course there are some economic repercussions that this influx of immigration is bringing upon our shores. What, in your views, are the economic limitations with the rise of immigration?
Well, first of all, immigrants are a source of cheap labor. They are exploited, and they also undermine the job market. And then the question arises whether immigrants should be paid the same
wages as Maltese workers. I mean, is that a sort of discrimination if they are not, and if they're paid less?
There is a problem in that, because if on the one hand an employer employs a local, who could be seen rather as racist. On the other hand, if he employs an immigrant, it would be somewhat unfair towards the Maltese.
So do you see a dilemma?
Yes, because equality is difficult in practice. When it comes in reality, it is rather difficult. It is a delicate situation. It's not clear-cut. If you do that, you could be termed as races. If on the other hand you would employ an immigrant or a refugee, then it would be unfair towards the Maltese, since we are such a large population and since the opportunities are...
At this point, I would like to also take a comment from Nicole, because she seems to have a differing view over here. What are your views on this economic repercussions, Nicole?
Well, my point is that once that these illegal immigrants gain refugee status, they are in fact becoming part of the citizens of the island.
But first, I think we need to take into consideration the Maltese who are born in Malta, and I mean I think they should have more so I think that the Maltese future could be somewhat at stake, because as I have already said, that our opportunities are limited. So I think the first preference should be given to the actual Maltese citizens.
I tend to disagree with your point of view. Mm-hmm. We have to take into consideration that illegal immigration is in fact has been receding in past years. Nevertheless, the point of the Libyan crisis in general, by now.
Yeah, exactly so.
But the thing is that
thousands are coming in.
The concept of burden sharing has to come into place at one point or another.
So but it's you not see, working.
Is there the question is there a future for the concept of burden sharing?
I don't
sharing?
Think so. I think there could be a future, but the point is that it has already been tried. The point is also that various statesmen and politicians have said it's not working. Verheugen, Merkel, Cameron, they said that.
But they said
integration is not working as well. So I think it's very difficult. It's very difficult to implement these things because the North won't accept further.
The North is in Northern European countries within the European Union.
Exactly, as Sweden. So it will be even more difficult to implement such a policy of burden
and
sharing.
We can always hope for a better future, and this prospect can either way go on for a very long time. But the fact is, if we go back to the original question, that yes, illegal immigrants, when they obtain the refugee status, are being exploited by local employers. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that when they gain the status, they are in actual fact entitlement to be integrated in the local market.
I am. It is very interesting that you are mentioning this concept of exploitation. Do you believe that there are enough mechanisms within the government structures to protect the immigrants from this exploitation which they are exposed to by the employers? Mm-hmm.
To go on to this very point, Malta has started since, I believe, 2007 or 2008, this system of integration. Mm-hmm. But in some aspects, Malta is actually behind European countries in the fact that there are anti-discriminatory policies which are not actually in place by now. But I think there is room for improvement, and we are improving.
So there is an integration policy,
there
you
is.
Are saying. Okay.
We can see this with regards to cultural orientation. Indeed, we can see this in the education programs that students have been receiving so far.
Mm-hmm. Justine, if we compare this integration policy, which Nicole is saying that it exists in Malta, if we compare it to integration policies which have been implemented in Northern European countries, because you mentioned them previously, such as the Netherlands, for instance, do you think that we have failed in our integration measures?
If not failed, there are many problems. There are many difficulties which have to be faced. Also, if I can quote Merkel, for example, she stated that multiculturalism is almost dead because it was really not working. Ghettos were being formed, cultures, because obviously when somebody feels threatened, then you feel more the urgency to protect your own culture. And after all, multiculturalism assumes cultures can just rub along each other. However, I believe that the reality is that cultures compete for dominance, and I think that conflict is endemic. Because, after all, it is about power. It is about power and
power within society.
Within society, exactly. And also, culture it cannot be compartmentalized to just food and dress.
There's also the political new.
It is the common out. It is the common outlook on life that people possess. Mm-hmm. I think it's. That's very important. It gives you a sense of history that a common group has. People they share common aspirations, common phobias, and it is also backed by a religious context. In our case, for example, in the case of Malta, So what I believe is that by definition, a group is exclusive and not inclusive.
You are mentioning religion. It is worth noting that in Malta, the church institutions have much pronounced their commitment towards integrating migrants in our society, much more than the political parties did. What are your views on this?
In fact, the church, I think it was among... It was among the first institutions that gave a positive outlook to...
In fact, there are many prominent organizations. You have at one point the GRS, who's doing a lot of work into
the Jesuit state. Refugee Service.
Exactly, yeah. They have been trying to push forward the idea into government that these refugees need to be given adequate services, taken well care of, given economic aid. Anything to give them a source to live in the island adequately.
And they have also been very prominent in the media. You see them all the time in television, in radio stations. They try to make this process easier for the Maltese and
so
for
you believe
the immigrants.
This is the way how we can change and empower civil society to express more commitments towards the immigration policy.
It could be a way, definitely.
We often hear the government talking about this crisis as if it was a national crisis. However, we don't have to use these terms so much. I mean, we can go down to the essence of the question and realize that is just a temporary question. We can actually integrate immigrants into our society, but it's a lifelong process, sort of.
It takes time
to develop.
I thank you very much for your interactive debate so far. Certainly, you have mentioned a lot of relevant points and we have had an active debate. I hope that the audience are as interested as we are, and I do invite all our listeners to join our conversations by sending their emails on info@mrsa.org.mt or else by visiting our online forum on mrsa.org.mt. I have with me our special guest for today, Dr. Neil Falzon, who is a university lecturer in human rights, migration and asylum. He's also a founding member of the recently established human rights NGO, Aditus. I welcome you to this debatable, Dr. Falzon.
Thanks. Good morning.
What I wanted to discuss, first of all, with you is how should we draw the line between legal and an illegal immigrant? We know that sort of all immigrants are trying to escape from their home country and trying to establish a better future in their prospective host country. But where do we draw the line between legal and illegality in migration? Mm-hmm.
The distinction is essentially one based in a country's immigration legislation. It's important to start off by saying that every government has a right to protect its borders and to decide who can enter its borders and who cannot enter the borders. And for that, they enact what is known as immigration legislation. An irregular migrant is essentially a person who is not a national of a state and is attempting to enter or to reside in that state in breach of immigration legislation. So we can speak of persons trying to enter a state without the necessary visa requirements, for example, or with forged documents, or a person who entered the territory legally with passports, with visas, etc., but then somehow became in an irregular status by, for example, overstaying their visa. It's important to mention when we speak about irregular migrants, there are a number of points that need to be clarified. First of all, in the Mediterranean and Maltese context, when we speak about irregular immigration, we're not only speaking about the persons fleeing from North Africa attempting to enter the EU, but essentially any third country national who might enter or reside in Malta in an irregular manner. And this could include persons who do not form part of the so-called boat people, but who enter Malta through any other means, including persons who overstay their visas. It's also good to mention the fact that within irregular immigration, we also talk about the notion of forced migrants, which are persons who, although attempting to enter irregularly, are maybe doing so because they have no other choice and have to enter in an irregular manner, as, for example, in most cases, refugees and persons fleeing civil war.
With regards to international instruments, are there any international mechanisms which Malta should be using in order to explain its conduct of policy vis-à-vis illegal immigration?
Yes, definitely. There's a long list of instruments to which Malta has a party which affect the way Malta develops its policy and legislation on migration issues. we can divide them in two broad categories, the international instruments and the regional instruments. Internationally, there are a number of conventions, mainly developed by the United Nations, which promote a certain standard of behavior by states vis-a-vis migration. For example, the International Convention on the Rights of Migrant Workers and Older Families. We have, for example, the Convention Against Torture, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So there are a long list of international instruments, to which Malta is a party, which are relevant for the issue. At a regional level, there are also many instruments promoted by the Council of Europe, which are also relevant for migration. And even within the EU has a number of specific directives and regulations which have a direct impact on Malta's behavior vis-à-vis migration. So membership of the EU forced Malta to enact the Refugees Act, which is the national legislation covering asylum seekers and refugees, which was a very good starting point for Malta to upgrade its standards. Mm-hmm. Over the years, the EU has adopted a number of relevant directives in the field of migration and asylum, and being an EU member, Malta was obviously, of course, obliged to transpose and implement the directives, which from a perspective of standards is definitely a positive step, because Malta has in fact to respect certain standards and be kept accountable for, for its behavior vis-a-vis those standards.
Dr. Neil Faltzon, I really thank you very much for accepting our invitation, and we hope to speak to you some other time on It's Debatable.
Thank you very much.
The discussion continues with my other two guests for today, Nicole Sherry and Justine Mikalev, who are second-year international relations students from the Department of International Relations, and we shall be talking about the concepts of brain gain and brain gain, most notably, and also with the immigration situation in the Mediterranean vis-à-vis the latest developments. Justine, when we talk about this immigration policy, I very much see that as Malta, as Maltese, we are much torn between realism and idealism in our policies. What are your thoughts on this?
Yes, I tend to agree with you, in the sense that even if we see the political elite, they are not very much pronounced when it comes to lobbying even the national interests of Malta within the EU, for instance.
And Nicole, do you have any views on this?
I have to agree with Justine. In fact, it is the United States of America which is actually taking a responsible share in the illegal immigrants which arrive in the Mediterranean.
In fact, the United States has been responsible for a lot of immigrants with regards to repatriation and integration within
the
US.
Even more than the EU has.
Than the EU members have had. Okay, I thank you very much for participating in today's show. We hope to speak to you again some other time on It's Debatable. A special thank you goes to Dr. Isabel Kalea, who's head of the International Relations Department, lecturer Ms. Chetamane Waring, and also special guest Dr. Neil Faltzon for their input. I, Darren Katkuta, thank you, our dear listeners, for joining us for today. Keep listening to Campus FM.
It's Debatable.